This is an interview with Jerry Rinardi on October 4th, 2015 in Wausau, Wisconsin. Hey, Jer.
Hi there. First of all, I'd like to say that this is a good idea that this is an audio recording because I've been told I have a face for radio.
No comment. All right. Let's talk a little bit about your job.
Okay.
What is your current job and who is your employer?
I work for the Wausau School District. I am employed as a German and Spanish teacher and the Global Language Department Chair.
Oh. How many global languages are in your department?
We have German, French, and Spanish right now.
Cool. So this year, what are you teaching? What's your course load?
My course load is 80% Spanish 2, which I team teach with a brand new teacher. And the other 20% is a combined German 4 and AP German class.
Wow. So, okay. So 80%. Is that new for you to have the majority? Is that recent for you to have the majority Spanish?
Very much so. It adjusts every single year based on the number of students that sign up for each language. And since I'm the only one in the department that is certified in two different languages that we offer, I'm the one that gets floated back and forth all the time. So, for example, 2 years ago, our other German teacher was transferred out of the building completely to cover German in other buildings, and I was transferred full-time into German. And then last year, I was transferred back into Spanish 60% because of changes in all the enrollments. And so last year was the first time it was my 24th year, it was the first time that I had ever had more Spanish than German, and this year that increased even more. So it's only the second time in my teaching career that I've had more Spanish than German.
Wow. Do you as the chair make those decisions about who?
No, actually, I work with our administration to make recommendations, but the decisions are ultimately made by the Human Resources Department and the principals.
Okay. Talk about, so you said last year was your 24th, this is your 25th?
This is my 25th year, yep.
And your entire teaching career has been at Wausau West, right?
It has. I'm a little bit of an anomaly these days in that there aren't very many people left in public education that get to spend this much time in one place. Mm-hmm. And certainly in our building, that's the case. One of my colleagues, this is the only place she's ever worked. But I shouldn't say that. She was the one that 2 years ago was transferred out of our building for a year. So she's been there, I think, 20 of her 21 years now. But it's a, you know, a little bit of a romantic I don't know what the word is I'm looking for there, but to be in one place for your whole career, I certainly hope that that's the way it works out for me.
Mm-hmm. 25. So what year then did you start?
1991.
1991.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So very cool. What's your average work week like? Talk about your week.
Average work week. Well, The work week stress starts about 3 o'clock Sunday afternoon, and it lasts until about noon on Saturday. And then from about noon Saturday till about 3 o'clock on Sunday is my downtime. I typically spend this year, because I drop Max off at school before I go in, I typically spend from about 7:20 till 4:30-ish in the building, and then I spend probably another, on average, 2 hours outside of school time working on school-related things, whether it's attending meetings or going to some kind of professional development that I need to go to, or just working on my own work outside of that. So it, you know, the hours add up. Typically, if I don't get done what I need to by the time I leave the building on Friday, I have to spend either Saturday morning or Sunday morning back in school. Mm-hmm. Not because because it's required of me to go in, but because if I try to do that work at home, there's too many distractions and I can't get it done.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, speaks to my inefficiencies during the day. Typically, I would much rather spend prep time talking to kids and working with them than doing what I should be doing with my own work. But unfortunately, a big part of that has also been a few years ago, the removal of release time for the department chair job. So a lot of the department chair duties that I have to do have to come out of my prep time now as well. So that's increased the amount of time I have to spend outside of the school day working on school work.
Got it. And what is your class schedule? Do you guys work the same every day of the week, or is it different each day, or how does
that? Yeah, no, by contract, we're supposed to be in the building from 7:30 to 3:30. We have homeroom from 7:45 until 7:55. We have classes from 8 o'clock until 3 o'clock. But we have what's called a flexible modular schedule, so it's not like a typical high school where you have an 8-period day. It's more like a college-type schedule. So for example, on Mondays, I have 4 classes of Spanish 2 that are each 35 minutes long. Then on Tuesdays, I only have 2 Spanish classes that are each 55 minutes long. And then the same thing on Wednesday. Thursday is back to the 4 35-minute classes. And then on Friday, it's actually a total of 4 Spanish classes, including the ones that my partner teaches in a large group scenario. So it's very different every day. Mm. And then we have a lab phase that I teach. I think it's 6 labs during the week. That's all technology-based, that's set up in advance. It's self-directed. Kids get instructions from a website, and we set up what we want the kids to do in advance, and then we go back and we do our grading and our feedback and things like that afterwards. So the most of the time that we put into the lab phase isn't during the 40 minutes, 35 minutes that the kids are actually in front of the computer. It's before and after.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty different that way, but it's every Monday is the same as the previous and the next Monday. Every Tuesday is the same, but Monday and Tuesday are different from each other.
Got it.
And so the weekly schedule is identical, but the daily schedule is different for everyone.
And how often do your courses change? Is that for the year? Is it a semester?
It's for the full year.
For the full year.
We run on a semester basis, but we have always tried in our department to make sure that all of our courses are scheduled at exactly the same time, both semesters, for ease of scheduling. And we typically have at least one. Last year we had 3 teachers that travel between buildings, and that makes scheduling very mm-hmm. difficult. So mm-hmm. We try to keep everything the same for both semesters for convenience sake.
And do the kids, are they in it for the year, or is that?
Our students are in their foreign languages for a year. Got also. It. It's a full year course. Mm-hmm. And so their Spanish schedule, for example, might change from one semester to the other.
Mm-hmm.
But they are in my class, for example, in Spanish 2, they are in it for the entire year.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What does your course planning, your lesson planning, your curriculum stuff, do you redo that? How often do you have to update that stuff and redo it? How much do you do and carry over year to year? And how much do you have to modify every year?
Virtually nothing of my daily or weekly planning is carried over from year to year.
Mm-hmm.
That has never been something that I've been comfortable with. It's never something that I felt worked. Each year when kids move from one level to another, there's a certain amount of growth that, or lack of growth that takes place, that you have to adjust what you do. Each year the dates are a little bit different. And so trying to squeeze the dates into a flexible modular schedule when your time frames might be different doesn't typically work. And quite frankly, the groups of students themselves and how motivated they are and how well behaved they are and everything else dictates a lot of whether or not we're able to use things from previous years. What I do take from year to year are experiences that I've done in the past. And, you know, if I've done an activity, for example, that I thought worked really well, I'll make sure to keep that in mind for the following year for planning purposes. If there's something that didn't work very well, I'll either try to figure out how to fix it or I'll toss the idea altogether. But a lot of the experiences and a lot of the activities and things we do carry over from year to year. A lot of the technology-based lab things, to me, it's always a huge bonus if I'm going through my planning for the following week and realize that last year's lab is going to work again. That's something that I don't have to do over again, and those take a tremendous amount of time. A couple of years ago, when I was the only person teaching German, I realized that I was spending about 4 hours a week just planning my classes, and then another 4 hours per week just planning that one phase of the class in the lab for all the different levels. So it was really an eye-opener to me about how much time that takes to set that kind of stuff up. And so anytime that I can find one that fits in perfectly like it did the year before, that's bonus for me.
Interesting. Going back to, you said you've got Spanish, French, and German, right? Is there any pressure to change that these days? I know Chinese is getting to be a big deal. Is that
constant pressure?
Oh yeah.
In fact, we've got two meetings left to complete a study that the school board commissioned last year after they made what we felt was a terrible decision. We had a requirement for every eighth grader to take a foreign language. And they, because of having to revamp the schedule system for the eighth graders, they voted last year to make eighth grade foreign language an elective again. So now there is not any point during the entire K-12 curriculum that students are required to take a foreign language at all, which anybody who's associated closely with foreign language knows that that's really going backwards with what the world needs right now. So at the same time they made that decision, they called a committee together to study how we can address this issue for our district. And of course that committee is very much in favor of bringing in something like Chinese or Arabic or something along those lines that are considered to be the fastest growing languages. Personally, I think it would be great if we could offer Chinese or another language, but I'm much more interested in whatever it is that we do, doing it well, rather than throwing together something that we can't sustain. And right now, the way things have been going in the state with Chinese, it's been very difficult to sustain because most schools are taking advantage of free teachers paid for by the Chinese government that come into a district for a year or two at the most, and then leave. And when you have that much turnover, it's impossible to grow a program because the kids do identify very well or not very well with certain teachers, and they either decide to stick with it or not, based more on the teacher than on their desire to learn the language in most cases. So we're finding that a lot of those districts that are doing that are having a really hard time maintaining their programs. And we're trying to find a way that if we do bring in a Chinese program, that it's something that we can sustain, that we'll have a teacher that's going to be here and not something that we got cheap and easy and just to say politically, hey, we did this, which unfortunately way too many administrators are in favor of doing, just touting that they brought something in. In fact, years ago, we had a gifted and talented elementary school program that was started that very way. The school board decided we were going to have a gifted and talented magnet school, but they didn't know how to make it a magnet. So during the summer, some administrator made a decision that foreign language was going to be the magnet and never told the foreign language department. We came back to school in the fall and found out they were offering French at this school, and we didn't know anything about it. And so, but this administrator was bragging to everyone around the central Wisconsin, look, we have elementary foreign language. And so we're trying to avoid those kinds of things. Ultimately, that program failed. It failed miserably because there was no planning involved and there was no plan for follow-up or success later on. And so what we're trying to be thoughtful about how we do that, and we're hoping that at some point we can expand. And, you know, my goal 10 years ago when I went through this process, for the second time, I'm going through it for the third time now, but my goal then was to have elementary foreign language in place by the time my kids got to kindergarten. And Max is in sixth grade now and Zoe's in fourth and we still don't have it. So that's kind of the way it's been working.
Interesting. In the time that you've been there, have you seen, what kind of changes have you seen in kids coming in? Are the kids today any different than the kids that were walking in the door in 1991?
I think the kids today are
kids today.
They are kids today, and there's very little about them that resembles the kids from when I first started. They really are, and in some ways they're very much the same. But we have way more kids today coming in that need parenting first and education second because they're not getting the parenting they need at home for whatever reason, and it's not I'm not just blaming parents, because a lot of times there are parents that just aren't able to give the parenting that they need, whether it's for socioeconomic reasons, which is mostly the case in our district, or whether it's for, you know, life difficulty reasons. But we have a lot more students that come to school not prepared to learn. And that's in many different ways, whether it's not having eaten properly, whether it's not having slept well. In some cases, we have kids, we've got families that don't know where they're going to sleep at night and where their next meal is going to come from. And there's no way that we can really educate those kids if they're not sure where they're going to be sleeping that night. But one of the other huge differences is the world that they live in technology-wise that that we never had to deal with, and the amount of time that our administrators and our police liaison officers spend working on cyberbullying, for example, it's unbelievable how much time takes away from their ability to be leaders and be, you know, to do positive things for education, because they have to be snuffing out these little fires that are taking place online all the time. But what the kids are getting as far as their own personal education from technology these days, just makes it a completely different ballgame than it was back then. And that in some cases for the better, in some cases for the worse, but mostly for the worse, unfortunately. Mm. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't be using it. I'm saying that we need to adjust what we do to address some of these things with our kids and use them so that kids understand how to use technology for their own benefit, for their educational benefit. Quite honestly, we're way behind on having teachers that are qualified to do that. We need teachers that are able to understand what their kids are doing, and there are aspects about the kids and technology and what they're doing today that I don't even understand. And occasionally, Zoe and Max will teach me something about what's going on with the technology that I didn't quite get before. Mm-hmm. And it's not that I couldn't understand; it's that I just don't take the time.
Right.
So it's easier just to have them explain it to me.
Uh huh. Is that becoming part of educational curriculum in education schools of education?
I don't know that. I don't have enough contact with what's going on now for training teachers. Mm-hmm. It should be. It definitely should be. It is something that we're trying to embrace little by little and very cautiously. This year, for the first time, I've launched a Twitter and a Facebook account for our global language department, so that we can start to get some exposure among our parents and among the students. Unfortunately, it's been launched. We haven't done much with it because I'm still not quite sure what I'm doing in that aspect, in that realm. But we're more and more teachers are, particularly younger teachers, are coming out and finding ways to use technology that the kids are using. The kids don't check their email ever anymore.
Right.
They don't use that as a mode of communication
right.
anymore. In spite of that, we are told that we're supposed to be sending emails to our kids when they need this or when they need that. And, you know, sending them an email is a little bit like sending a note home in the past in the backpack. Whether or not it ever made it home, nobody knows. But, you know, if you send them an email and tell them you have to check your email, well, if you have to tell them that, you might as well just tell them what you
right.
said in an email. So it's really defeating the purpose. We're kind of chasing our tail a little bit with that. I hope that they're going to be focusing a lot more on the advancing technology in teacher training. But even I don't know exactly how that can happen with the rapid advancement. By the time it gets into the curriculum to teach and training in training teachers, the kids have already moved on to something else.
Mm-hmm.
So it's difficult to keep up with.
Yeah. Yeah.
Particularly in a slow moving institution like education.
Sure. Huh. I wonder if, I have no idea, but I wonder if it'll sort of, if we're just, whether the pace of change will continue the way that it has, or if this is just the launch point and we'll catch up and plateau. No idea. But
I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is either. There aren't any indications right now to show it slowing down.
Mm-hmm.
We're being told that I think Max told us that he came home and one of the presentations they had at school said that out of every 20 students right now, 10 of them, by the time they graduate from college, will have jobs that haven't been invented yet. And we've heard that about high school kids, too, that a large number of the kids that we have in high school sitting in front of us, that by the time they get into the working world, the jobs they have not been invented yet. And so that kind of change, it's difficult to see that slowing down anytime soon.
Right. Huh. Interesting. How about parents? You mentioned the need of the kids, the change has been in the need to, that they need more parenting. Is there particular changes that you've seen in parents in that time, or has the demographic changed in your district, or?
Everything kind of ebbs and flows. And I think, you know, to use some of those cliches, the pendulum swings one way, it swings back the other way. And for a long time, the parents seemed to be in concert with the teachers. A teacher would call home and say, "This is what your son or daughter did," and the parent would say, "I'll talk to him and we'll come to some resolution." With the dawn of the technology age, with kids having cell phones and everything in school, we started to see a reversal where before the teacher could get a chance to talk to the parent, they were getting nasty emails from the parent or nasty phone calls from the parent because the student got to them first. And the parents were yelling at the teachers that they did something horrible to their kid. And once they found out what the real story was, they backed off a little bit. And now it's kind of coming back to the point where the parents they're starting to come back the other way to where they don't believe everything their kid says just because they texted them or just because they emailed them before the teacher did. And there's a lot more parent contact ahead of time than there used to be. You know, we can talk to a parent and say, "Look, this is what happened with your kid in my class today. And these are what our expectations are. And this is what we'd like you to talk to them about." And we're getting a lot more cooperation on that realm. But part of that is because parents are starting to understand more and more that they have very little control over what happens with their kids' technology. Mm-hmm. They're putting technology into kids' hands and then they don't know where it goes from there. And so they're starting to realize that they can't trust everything that their student says to always be 100% true when it comes to the teacher-student-parent relationship. But I think also, I can't speak for other teachers, but I have never ever been uncomfortable talking to parents. I've never been uncomfortable making a phone call or meeting with a parent in a difficult situation. And I've always tried to make the parents understand that the only reason that we're having this uncomfortable discussion is because I want what's best for their student. And there are way too many teachers that I see that are scared to have parent contact. And they're the ones that typically open themselves up to parents criticizing them or going to the principal and whining about the job they're doing and things like that. I think we're seeing more and more teachers coming into the profession that understand that they need those parents on their side, and they're reaching out to those parents in advance, and they are feeling more comfortable talking to parents. And so I think that's, you know, the school, I think, has kind of started to realize its role is parenting the students, but also parenting the parents to some extent about what their child's education is all about. And so, you know, I'm kind of hoping that things are going to improve on that side also. I might be in a little bit of a dream world because we are an elective area, and most of the kids that we have are there because they selected to be mm-hmm. there. They picked mm-hmm. the class. It might be completely different in some of the low-level math classes mm-hmm. with the least motivated kids and their parents. You know, they might still be seeing a lot of the resistance from the parents to help and things like that. But I don't know if I even answered your question.
No, that's fine. That's good. Then how about you? How have you changed as a teacher in this period?
I think probably the biggest change that I've experienced in myself is the empathy the sense of empathy to what students have going on. There was a time when I first started that I might not have understood why a student wasn't able to do what I wanted them to do. And I would take it personally. And I think every teacher goes through that when they first start. They don't understand why kids don't do what they do. And then as you grow as a teacher and you experience all kinds of different things, you start to realize that the vast majority of the kids that are in front of you want to make you happy. They want to do what you are asking them to do, but there's something else that's getting in the way of that. And if you approach them from that standpoint and say, look, I want you to be successful. I want you to do well. I want you to feel good about what you're doing. You're going to get a lot better results than if you say, why didn't you have your homework done again? You can never seem to get this done. What's your problem? You know, and don't get me wrong. There are times that that's appropriate to say to a kid that, you know, if you've given a student so many chances and they keep bucking you on the chances, you do have to get firm with them. But the biggest area of growth personally, I think, is in the empathy area of trying to see through their eyes what might keep me from getting to where I need to be. And then the other area that I think I've changed, about 2 years ago, I had an opportunity to apply for a different job within the district. And it would have been a job that I would not have had as much student contact in. And I didn't know if I wanted to leave the classroom at that time. And I went through a really difficult period of trying to decide whether or not, if they had offered me this job, which thankfully they didn't. But I went through a really difficult time of figuring out whether or not I would have taken it, because I didn't know what I really wanted out of that job versus the job that I'm in. And when it came down to it, what I realized at the end was, and I've heard this argument on a number of different job openings and possibilities, think of how many more kids that you can affect if you do this job. And my response now after going through that process has become, it's not about how many kids I affect. It's about how profoundly I can affect them by doing it personally rather than from some job at central office. But more importantly, it's the effect they have on me from year to year to year. And every single one of them leaves a mark on you somehow that helps you grow as an educator and helps you be a better teacher, a better person. And that's something that I never expected when I first started. Was, you know, I went in kind of idealistic, thinking that I was going to be this great change for a lot of kids. And what I never realized was how much they were actually changing me in the process.
Mm. That's neat.
It is. It's a pretty neat feeling.
Yeah. Hmm. I'm going to shift gears a little bit here and go back into what's involved in your in the department chair role. What are your responsibilities as chair?
The department chair role has changed quite a bit in the last couple of years. But when they took away the release time that we had, they realized that they had to take a lot of our management duties away and things that we had to do during the school day they couldn't expect us to do anymore. So they've actually changed the title now from department chair to department leader, and which I think is an interesting change because they really haven't told us what they want us to do differently now that we have a different title. But some of the biggest things, I oversee the budget for our department, which isn't a huge budget, but it's one that, there are times that you can get into squabbles with the people in your department over where you spend your money and things like that. I was in a 5-year battle with one of our current teachers over the fact that I wouldn't spend department money on Kleenexes for her classroom. Those kinds of little things that come up. Day to day, it's a lot of putting out fires. Everything that is needed by any of our teachers in order for them to do their job, I'm the first one they go to try and get it. So if there's something that's not working right, even if it's a conflict with another person in the department or outside the department, teachers generally try to avoid conflict with other people. So they go to their department chair first and say, you need to go talk to this person. And, you know, typically my response is, no, it's your issue. You need to go and talk to them. And that usually means that either they will just bury it and hold mm-hmm. a grudge, Or occasionally, if it's something that they're a little more comfortable with, they will go in and handle it. But so, you know, a lot of little putting out fires. In the last several years, it was about 6 years ago or 7 years ago that we actually started the lab phase again, which is all computer based. And that was something that I led our department into and through. And now I've kind of created a little bit of a monster, because the anytime there's any kind of technology issue, they come to me. And the expectation is that I'm going to drop everything and fix their problem right now. And I try to do that, but I can't always. And so, you know, sometimes I have to tell them, you know, I'm sorry, but you're just going to have to deal with it for now, and I'll get to it when I can. In the spring of the year is when the responsibilities for me really ramp up. In the spring of the year, I'm responsible for working with the administration. Once we find out how many kids have registered for our foreign languages, I work with the administration to help determine the staffing, to make recommendations on who should be teaching which classes and which levels. And then it's my responsibility to do all of the scheduling for the entire department. So, and that's a pretty big job. But when I first started, we had, I think it was 8 full-time teachers in our department, and we're down to a total of 5 right now, I believe. And the scheduling part of it has gotten easier, obviously, as we've reduced our staff by nearly 50%. So it's that part of it has gotten a little bit easier to do, but it takes a tremendous amount of time in the schedule system that we have. It's not an easy thing at all. We have weekly department chair, what we call PLC, which is professional learning community meetings, where we meet with the administration and we discuss whatever kind of issues are coming up with our building and how we might go about solving them. And sometimes those meetings result in us needing to meet with our department. I have to lead weekly meetings with my department that are our department level PLC, as they're called. From a leadership standpoint, what I'm supposed to do as a department chair is to keep abreast of what some of the newer and more I don't want to say more modern, but more effective you know, methods and things like that come out. The expectation is that I'm keeping up with that kind of stuff, or that I'm also keeping up aware of conferences that are coming up and who from our department might be going. And over the last several years, there's been a tremendous push to go toward what's called the communicative approach of teaching foreign language, where you don't worry about whether or not the kids have things grammatically correct or whether their pronunciation is perfect. What you worry about is whether or not they got their point across, which to me makes a lot more sense. Mm-hmm. Because when you learn to speak English, you didn't learn to speak it correctly. You learned to get your point across. Right. And this kind of mirrors that. And it's very difficult to take a group of people who have been teaching as long as our foreign language teachers have and tell them that the grammar is not that important anymore, and to try and lead them into a direction where, the grammar, they need that for structures, but when you read this essay and it's not grammatically correct, did you understand it or not? Did you understand what they were saying? And if you did, then the bulk of their grade should reflect that they were able to communicate with you. And so, that's been one of the bigger challenges as the leader side of this job, is trying to get people to move away from what they've always known and done into something new and different.
That's really interesting. I don't think I did very well in my Spanish classes in high school, and I definitely didn't retain anything. I actually hit this point when I was in the Dominican Republic on a trip in high school, where I was mid-sentence, and I think that year was my senior year, and I don't even think I was still in classes. And I had done pretty well for the first couple of days trying to make my way through. And then I was literally mid-sentence saying something and got stuck, and I don't think I've been able to say a thing since that moment. But I definitely, in the last few years, it dawned on me that, like, all of the rules, all of the grammar, I was trying to apply it. I wanted to fit it into a comparison to English, which I now am like, that doesn't make any sense at all, it's an entirely different thing. It's not... You can't say this is supposed to, you know, this is how it is in English, this is how it is here, and do that one-to-one. So I thought, man, if I had thought about it differently, I wonder if I would have learned it better. Is that grammatically correct?
In Spanish, it is. Yeah. You know, it's funny that you say that because it seems like kids fit into one of two categories when it comes to foreign language. They either do learn it exactly the way that you're describing by making a direct comparison, uh-huh, where that you'd say, this is how you do it in English and this is how you do it in Spanish. Uh-huh. And we spend, or in German for that matter, and we spend a tremendous amount of time teaching kids English in our foreign language classes and how this works and how that works. And there are some kids that learn very, very well that way. Mm-hmm. And there are other kids that just can't do that. And so, you know, we have to continuously try to find a happy medium there. Back to your story about getting to mid-sentence, you are exactly where I, over the years, I've devised a number of my own theories of foreign language education that I've shared with my students on a regular basis. And one of, about 3 years ago, the kids that graduated, one of their favorites of my theories that I threw at them was what I called the foreign language cul-de-sac. You drive down this road with a sentence, and then all of a sudden, you can't get out. You're stuck there, and you can't find your way out. And so you have to find a way to backtrack to where you were in order to move forward. And after I told them about this little theory of mine, this image I had of their linguistic cul-de-sac, there would be kids that constantly in class would be in the middle of a sentence and say something, oh, there's that darn cul-de-sac again. So, you know, that is out there. But the you know, and that's exactly what this whole shift toward the communicative approach is designed to do, is get people away from. And I also have a theory, too, that I've shared with my kids, that you get to a point where you can learn all the foreign language you want, and you're not going to be able to do anything with it until you stop trying to do it correctly. Mm. You have to just let go and do it, because if you don't, you're paralyzed and fluency will never come. If you're too worried about correctness, mm-hmm, fluency will never come. But the opposite is it is the opposite. If you don't worry about correctness, fluency will come and then correctness will follow. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's the way to go. And I very often have that conversation with kids when we're getting further advanced, where they're trying to have conversations. And I can see that in their minds, as they're trying to talk, they're slowing themselves down because they're worried about whether or not the verb is conjugated, mm-hmm, correctly, or whether they're using the dative case. And I have to sit and tell them, you know what? The only thing between you and doing really well with the language is that you're too worried about doing it right. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember who the famous author was, but somebody showed me a quotation just a few days ago that said, the best way to learn a foreign language is to start speaking it badly.
Yeah.
And you know, just forget about. And that, by the way, is one of the most difficult parts of our jobs as high school teachers, because kids, teenagers, have been taught that being wrong is the worst thing you can,
right,
do. And so that stigma of being wrong in front of your peers is extremely difficult to overcome as educators, to get them to take risk. And mm-hmm, so I've even gone to some conferences where they've talked about the fact that students in foreign language classes need to have risk taking as part of their grade, that because they need to know that the only way they're going to advance in a foreign language is by taking some risks. Mm-hmm. And so therefore their grade should somehow reflect that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that carries all the way through. I mean, I have employees who I need at times to be able to take more risks and be okay with being raw. I need them to make decisions and be okay with the fact that you just have to own the decision, and it might not be right. And if it's not, but you had a few choices and none of them were great, and you know,
right.
And then but this fear. Yeah. I know I'm terrified of doing it badly, speaking a foreign language badly, but it's interesting because it's not like it occurs to me to give somebody a hard time who I can tell is not a native English speaker. It wouldn't occur to me to think anything about the fact that they didn't say it perfectly, you know. I think if writing became too difficult to, if it was not communicative, as you said, then that would at some point become a problem. But that's for somebody who actually wants to, depends on what you want to do. If you actually want to work in whatever level it is and what the requirements of the role would be, would require different levels of fluency and grammatical
Yeah, exactly. Acumen, and that's, you know, that's something that we assume that most of our kids are taking a language because they want to learn it. Now, Spanish is a little bit of a different animal in that there are a lot of kids out there that are still under the belief that they have to take 2 years of something to get into college. And so our single largest drop-off in enrollments is between Spanish 2 and Spanish 3, because that's the first myth, is that they have to have 2 years to get into college, which most places that is not true. They recommend it strongly, and they you know, all things being equal, they'll take a kid who has foreign language over one who doesn't, but it's not a requirement in most places. But the other myth is that Spanish is the easy one, and that's why that's where we have our biggest enrollments. You know, that's part of it. I shouldn't say that's why. Most people put their kids in Spanish because they say that's what they're going to use around here. They're not going to use German or French around here. Well, the vast majority of our students that go through 4 or 5 years of foreign language, if they're going to use the foreign language, they're going to find a way to use it, whether it's German or French or Spanish. Mm-hmm. It doesn't, you know, they're not going to go take 4 years of German and then go to Mexico and expect to understand what's going on. They'll mm-hmm. find a way to use their German if that's something that's important to them. But the kids that aren't sure what they want to do, or are sure that they don't want to take a foreign language, but they have to because they need something to get into college, they typically will tend to go into Spanish because that's where they've got this myth out there that that's the easy one, quote unquote. So, it's an interesting, interesting beast.
So you've hit one of my, I had some questions about just kind of, here's some theories. I don't even know if they're theories, but things that I'm interested in. But another one is good classes and bad classes. Like the year, like that's a great, is there any merit to that? Do you have entire classes where you're like, man, this class is a beast, or this one, that was just a really great class that year?
Absolutely. I think I've had a lot fewer of them the more experience I've gotten in dealing with difficult kids, but as far as classes, are you talking about like a graduating class of kids, or are you talking about like seventh period is really naughty kids?
More graduating class. Okay. Of.
I'll tell you that as I started out by saying 25 years in, there's been one class of kids that I did not go to graduation.
Oh.
And I didn't go for two reasons. One, because I couldn't stand them. And two was, it was our anniversary, and I used that as an excuse not to go to graduation. But the group of kids that I had in that particular class were bullies. I had 12 kids in this class, and 8 of them were bullies. And they were bullies to each other. They were bullies to kids outside of the classroom. And I witnessed so much of them being arrogant and condescending and just, there's no better way to describe it other than bullying other kids, that I truly didn't like them. And they didn't learn very well. They didn't do very well. And from that group of kids, I have zero post-graduation contact. And that's the only graduation class that I don't have some contact with some of the kids. Which I think is really interesting. And the contact I have with post-graduation kids is almost never initiated by me. It's when kids seek me out somehow to have some sort of friendly relationship outside of school after everything is done. There was that one group. Now, whether or not that might have changed today with what I know now and the experience I have now, whether I would have been able to have some sort of effect on them today in order to make that better, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's possible that I could have done something differently, in order for that not to be the case with that group. But it was kind of like the perfect storm. It was a group that was very, very intelligent, very smart, had no leaders in it. They had nothing but followers. And so anybody who spoke up, everybody else thought was pretty cool. And the people who spoke up were the bullies. So that they became the leaders. And that was, you know, that was a very difficult thing to deal with that group of kids. On an individual basis, because of our FlexMod system, it's one class a week that you have difficulty with because of the makeup of the kids. It's not one class. It's not seventh period every day that you have trouble with. Mm-hmm. For me, it's mods 19, 20, 21 on Wednesday. And it, last year and this year. And they're not bad kids. They just talk too much. And so I have to make sure that I can set them in a seating chart where things will work in my favor and not their favor. But it's not like, you know, there are in a traditional schedule, there are teachers that definitely say, oh, fourth period English, I just can't stand that group of kids because of the way they behave. That doesn't happen very often with our system. But I can tell you that what's happening more and more often is things like, and this is away from the public education realm, but Diana and I both taught Max's CCD class last year's faith formation class. And what we started to realize in that class, we had one student in that class who was extremely disruptive. And it wasn't until he was sick one night that we realized how much of our energy and effort we were spending on that one student mm-hmm. that was taking away from our ability to instruct the rest. Mm-hmm. And don't get me wrong, these are fifth grade kids. So we were constantly redirecting the boys who were very energetic and talkative and everything, and the girls were angels. We never had to redirect them. They were very respectful. They wanted to learn. So there was definitely a maturity issue between the males and the females to begin with. But this one young man also was a special needs student, and it really was, to me, absolutely that kind of slap in the face that says, wow, when you have a particular student that has particular needs in your classroom, that can really, really make a difference between whether or not those kids learn and whether they or not. Mm-hmm. And I started putting myself in the place of his fifth grade teacher that had him in the classroom all day long and wondering how much are the rest of those fifth graders in his class getting if he's this demanding and disruptive in our 75-minute class. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you ask if there's anything in the theory to that about a good class or a bad class, and this is not a bad kid. He's a nice kid. When mm-hmm. we see him one-on-one, he's a very nice kid. He just, the smallest thing can set him off, and he blurts out constantly, and we have to constantly redirect his behavior. It does make things pretty difficult, and we're seeing more and more of that, mm-hmm. More and more of those kinds of situations where you have a special needs student in the classroom that is a good person, but making it very difficult for everyone to learn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. Mm-hmm. Do you have a favorite season or event every year? Like, is there a time of year that's your favorite?
Personally, or you mean this with that, with regard to the job?
With regard to the job, yes.
A favorite event. I think that we do every year, we do a morning breakfast that we call our Wall of Excellence ceremony. And every department gets to select a student that they feel was the, since our school is the Wausau West Warriors, was basically most epitomized what a warrior is in their department. And since we have three different languages, we were comparing apples to apples by trying to select one from the department. So we actually give one per language. But there are, I think, 18 or 19 students that are selected from all the different departments that are show up at this breakfast this morning. And it's absolutely awe-inspiring what the collective talent is of this group of people that is graduating from high school. And it's one of those things that no matter how difficult a year you have, you know that the future is going to be in pretty good hands with this group of people going out there, and that they're going to be changing the world somehow. And you know that down the road, you're going to be seeing them out in the world doing something amazing, mm-hmm. something brilliant. And so I think for that reason, it's a small, little more intimate celebration with parents are there. The kids are there and the teachers are there. But it's small enough that you get to interact with them a little bit and you get to talk to the parents about what great things their kids are doing. And that's not something that we get to do real often. So, that I think is probably my favorite event of the year.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
All right. Do you have Is there anything from your upbringing or from, you know, from mom or dad that you feel you particularly has been important to you in your career to bring into your career as part of your what makes you a good teacher?
What didn't I get from them that, you know, the growing up and learning to work hard at whatever you do. And I wasn't the best at that when I was growing up, but, you know, never really understanding what the reason was for working hard until I had to, until I finally figured it out about my junior year in college. I'm constantly telling kids that I don't care what their grade is. What I want is their best effort. What I want is the best out of them. And if the best that they can do is a C, then we'll make that feel like an A, you know. But one of the things that particularly from mom that I remember her telling me once when I was going over to Russ's house to stay overnight, Russ Ackerman's house. And before I left, she kind of looked at me and with a little smile on her face said, she said, when you leave his room after you stay overnight, it should look better than when you got there. And that was, you know, when we grew up and we all had our chores that we had to do and keep everything neat and tidy around the house that we grumbled about constantly. Well, that never left me. And that's something that I always kind of felt like it's not just leaving a friend's room. It's leaving any room that you walk into better than when you got there. But that, you know, those are guiding words, mm-hmm. You know, they're so simple. And if everybody did that, you think about where our world would be.
Mm-hmm. So she says that she meant dust the baseboards. That's gonna, you're going to feel a little silly.
Dust Russ's baseboards is what she meant exactly. Yeah, I felt a little weird picking up Russ's laundry and showing his mom what a great job I had done of cleaning up his room.
Right.
But you know, just, you know, everything. I mean, when Dad needed to have wood cut and split and hauled for the heat in the wintertime and didn't have the time to do it himself, you know, he taught us about working hard for what you earn and paying us to do the job. Now it was slave labor wages, I'll say, but and I think Dad probably to this day still snickers about how much warmth he got out of our blood, sweat, and tears for $5 a cord or whatever it was that came out to 37 cents an hour. But no, it was, you know, and it wasn't just that we were being taught to do it for the money. It was that we were being taught to do it to contribute to our family, to mm-hmm. our community. And you know, I don't know how you can, those two things, you know, being taught to contribute to your community and being taught to make places better than when you started, I don't know how you can have anything better upbringing for preparing you for education.
Yeah, they're pretty good. All right, all the way as we start to wind up here, all the way in the other direction, what do you do for lunch every day?
Well, it's funny that you should ask that now because I was often criticized by my colleagues for being a creature of habit that I would bring the exact same lunch to school every single day when I would go and sit with the same seven or eight people in the faculty lounge every day. And it was a turkey sandwich with Swiss cheese and 12 grain wheat bread, and it would be a banana, a thing of yogurt, and a cookie from the lunch line. And last year when I went, our district has been doing a wellness initiative for the last several years where if you participate, you don't have to do much, but if you participate, you get you get a refund on part of your health insurance premium. And so last year, Diana and I participated for the fourth year, and we got something like $800 back on our health insurance, which is pretty substantial. So I thought, well, I'm going to keep participating. But last year, I had to do some extra stuff because I had put on 5 pounds over the previous year. And so then all of a sudden I had extra things I had to do in order to make the level I needed to make for this wellness initiative and to get that money. And this year I thought, I'll be damned if I'm going to be over, quote unquote, overweight again. So this year, and not to mention that this year, we've got the puppy at home now that we got just at the end of last school year. So most days I come home and take him out quick, and I have a banana, maybe an apple, and a Slim Fast shake for lunch. And that's about it. And then I'm eating little morsels of cereal throughout the school day. I've got some mini wheats or something at school that I'll be munching on throughout the day so that I don't end up starving to death. And somehow I still feel like I end up starving by the end of the day. But that's been what I've been having for lunch this year so far.
Yeah.
Next week is our wellness check again for the year. They've moved it from February to October. And so I'm kind of trying to decide whether or not, as soon as this wellness check is over, whether I'm going to go back to my turkey sandwiches, because I'm not sure that I'm liking the discomfort of being hungry most of the day.
Right.
Yeah. Plus, at the end of the day now, Max goes from, he takes the bus from John Muir to West and then rides home with me. He comes to my office. And so usually the snacks that I have set out for myself on my desk, by the time I get back to my desk, he's already eaten them. So I come home extra hungry because he'll eat my apple or he'll eat my cereal or whatever it is. So
nice. All right. And last but not least here, give us a list of all of your jobs that you can remember doing.
In my whole life?
Yep.
Okay. First one was working at Grandview Apple Orchard. You just want to know where they were or what I did?
You can say what you did.
Oh, that was the worst. One of the worst. That most of that job was in the summertime. Macintosh apples grow in clumps. And if you don't break up the clumps, they grow deformed apples and break the branches because they get too heavy. So I would spend about 6 weeks, about 6 to 7 hours a day, just climbing up trees and breaking up the clumps and throwing the apples on the ground, which was horribly boring. You were out in the hot sun listening to the only radio station that would come in, which played the same music every 4 hours, so you knew what was on constantly. It was really awful. And then every now and then you'd put your ladder into a tree and there'd be a bee's nest in there and you get stung by bees. And I mean, it just wasn't any fun at all. But they paid $2.75 an hour.
There
so,
you go.
Yep. And when you're 14, that's good money. Mm-hmm. So, then from there, I went to working at McDonald's, where I got fired for having a bad attitude, which I still to this day kind of laugh at. I got my job at McDonald's because the owner, Jack Frost, was my baseball coach at the time, and his nephew was the head manager. And the assistant head manager hated the fact that he would give jobs to his baseball players. She just hated that. And so when I walked through the door and got the job because I was one of his baseball players, she hated me instantly. And then I turned out to be one of their best employees up at front at the counter. And I'm not bragging here, what I'm saying by one of the best, there were a number of particularly elderly customers that would come into McDonald's almost every day for their dinner. And they would always come to my line, even if there was somebody else that was available. They would wait in line for me because they felt that I treated them better than other people. In the 2.5 years, I think it was, or a year and a half, I can't remember how long it was that I worked there, they kept track of how often your drawer was off with giving change back to customers. And in 2 years, there was nobody, including the full-time employees, that had a more accurate drawer than I did. And that didn't seem to matter at all. I got to back up a little. About 2 months after I got the job, Jack Frost sold the McDonald's and moved to Florida and took his nephew with him. So she now became the head manager. Mm-hmm. So for about a year and a half, I was living with being a nearly top performing employee and being told that I wasn't ever doing anything right when I knew I was, and other people were doing the same job I was and not doing it as well and getting complimented for it and getting raises for it. And so eventually, yeah, I did have an attitude problem. oddly enough, that same head manager that ultimately let me go because of my attitude, I still bump into her every now and then because she owns the McDonald's in Merrill and the one in Tomahawk where we spend a lot of our time during the summer. So I look at that and think to myself that I may have lost that battle, but I definitely won that war because she's still doing that after all this time. After that, I worked for Jeff Zalewski painting, and that was an okay job. It was a huge jump in pay from what I was getting at McDonald's. The work was hard, but I liked it. I liked the guys that I worked with. I got to do I'd had some really awful jobs for them. But I got to find ways to kind of have some fun with it. Like when I was painting the public library and I put a white piece of paper over the L in public and then ran across the street and took a picture of what it said. So I worked with him during the summers. When I got to college, I had a job my freshman year. It was a work study job where I was the gym supervisor at the physical education building, which was awful. It was sitting at a desk for 3 hours or 6 hours a week checking IDs, but it was called federal work study, but they wouldn't let us do any work while we were there. We just had to sit there. The next year I worked the food service. I had a job working in the dish room in the serving line or wherever it was. I worked for them for a year and a half and then got a job as a student manager of the union building. It was called the Davies Center. And so I worked as a student building manager for 2 years. And the student building managers, basically we were the manager of the building when the full-time staff went home. So from 4 o'clock until midnight when the building closed during the week, and then all weekend long, we were the ones that were in charge of the building. And that was one that I really learned a lot in that job. Well, I learned a lot from all of them, but that one is, I think, where I learned the most about working together with other people, because we were in charge of the full-time maintenance crew, which was the custodial staff. And most of these guys were old enough to be my dad, and I was their boss. And so, you know, some 21-year-old, 22-year-old kid is going to give you instructions on what you're supposed to do. You've got to learn a lot about how to talk to people and things like that. So that was really kind of a neat job. Very, very little actual work, but a ton of responsibility in that job. And that's kind of a fun aspect of that job, was having some responsibility and growing some confidence and things like that. And actually that job led directly to my teaching job, because I happened to be working. The year that I was student teaching, I was not allowed to have a job while I was student teaching. So I couldn't do my manager job other than one shift on the weekend. And at the end of the first semester, everybody else had gone home, and they needed somebody to cover the graduation ceremony for the midterm graduation. And at that ceremony, my Spanish professor came up to me and grabbed me by the hand and said, "I need to introduce you to someone." And she pulls me through the crowd and introduces me to a man named Lou Santangelo, who was the Spanish teacher and the foreign language department chair for Wausau West High School, who was there to tell me that they had a German teacher who was going to be retiring, and asked my professor, Roma Hoff, her name was, asked her if she knew anybody that might be able to fit the bill. And she told him, "You wait right here, I'll bring him to you." And so she took me and introduced me to him. And so my foot was in the door before anybody else even knew the guy was retiring.
Wow.
And so that was kind of neat how that all played out there.
That is neat.
So, yep, cool. That was it.
That was it. Awesome.
Probably a lot longer description of those jobs than you wanted.
No, that's cool. Very cool. All right. Thank you.
Certainly. My pleasure.